Right on. Let me know if we have a clear connection.
I think we do.
All right. Sounds
I think
good.
the voices, the volume levels are okay. I was getting a little reverb there at the beginning, but I think we can live with that.
I just turned the volume down a bit so it doesn't play back into the speakers.
Good, good, good. How's
Yeah.
the Yukon today?
Oh, bright and sunny, nice and beautiful. Not melting or anything. It's been good, so borderline normal. How are things down there in Ohio?
It's cold.
Is it?
We're cold, man.
Oh, how
Windy and
cold is it?
cold, and had a little bit of snow this morning. So,
Oh, very nice.
yeah.
Well, that makes it cheerful.
I guess. I guess we're going to talk about the Meyer material. I have, as I always do when I go into this stuff, I go down all these other different tangents and little side streets, and
Yeah.
it's hard for people to realize how much information is here, and it's just a little bit staggering. I have these folders, and each folder has, well, it's like a little book, and each little book has like seven maybe folders in it with pockets, and then I try to put the contact reports in there. I print them out, and then I make a little table of contents so that I can, find things when I want to find things.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, because I've gotten away from reading them online. I'm trying to get away from doing that because I'm in front of the computer too much anyway. And when
Yep.
you read them online, it's supposed to be really bad for your consciousness, and I can feel the eye strain, among other things. So
Right.
I got in this habit of printing them out and then reading them. And
Wow.
you know how it's organized. It's the information is kind of, because it's conversational, it's a little bit here and then a little bit there. So you have to pull it together from different sources.
Exactly.
And in a way, it makes it more interesting that way. And so you don't have this monolithic thing to read all at once. You can
Right.
take it in chunks,
I
which is
know.
kind of good.
It is. Yeah. They mentioned that, I guess, something too with the some of the scientific language that we use is kind of not really helpful because it's so detaching us from the actual just being able to relate to it. So I think the way they design this in conversation form is actually very, very, very smart because it's so much more digestible and so on. So yeah.
So it makes it more interesting.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And easier to remember too. I mean, when you're just reading a dictionary, it's pretty much,
Pretty dull, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one thing to have it and use it once in a while, but it's not something that you want to sit down and read. Yeah.
I've been doing a heck of a lot of shows not related to the Meyer material, which is kind of out of my recent habits. That's kind of the way I started out, well, goodness, 7 years ago, doing shows, and they were, I'd buy a book and then try to get the guest that wrote the book, and I kind of attacked the UFO thing that way, the extraterrestrial thing that way. But and it was fun, and I think I had a lot of good shows, a lot of people shows that people could relate to. But it was still, it left a lot. It just barely whetted my appetite for the information. And
Right.
I got this gigantic wall here in front of me, and about three quarters of it is a bookshelf full of, all kinds of books that
Yeah.
I've read. But by far, the Meyer information is so much above all this other stuff. It's really hard to put into words. It's not so hard to tell you or to tell listeners that have been listening for a while, but to have another person from the UFO community on and then try to explain to them why they should pay attention to this material
Yeah.
is a little bit of a challenge. I had a couple folks that my last show, I don't know if you heard that one or not, I very seldom ever debate with anyone.
Oh, I heard that. Yes. Yeah, I know.
And We had a bit of a debate. It was intense, but I wouldn't say too tense. And I think we enjoyed it, and just because I sent them messages back and forth after the interview, and we all were on pretty good terms. So,
yeah.
But I, it's just, it's hard. The situation is like this: when you study this material, you have thoughts that other people just can't have and won't have and won't understand. And it takes, you have to build like this whole frame of reference for them to really even begin to wrap their mind around what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
So,
there's a lot of research that goes into getting to a stage where you can sort of see the stuff and see it for what it is. And it takes research. It takes a lot of effort, and it's not something you should just believe, as you were mentioning on the show too, and the last show that you were doing. And I think that's, you know, that's pretty important. But everyone has to take those steps themselves. Well, it's actually making me think of another book that I read that's not related to the Meyer material in any way, but it's actually a Stanford sort of a study that this guy took a bunch of his some of his best students over the many years that he'd been a professor there, and he was talking about one of the things. The book is called Good to Great: How Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they had this whole set of criteria and everything, and before they even started, and only 11 companies out of thousands made it into the study. And then they would have comparison companies that were in the same industry that might have been, you know, not even heard of at that time and all that kind of thing. And then later on, they would overtake the big companies that were, you know, well established and all this kind of stuff. And anyway, so, but one of the things in that is that the ones that actually did manage to make that leap were the ones that they would argue and debate, make a decision, argue and debate, make a decision. You know, it wasn't just being what they described as plastic people. They wouldn't just be yes men to everything. I found that very interesting, because, you know, it's like me and my dad when we do carpentry projects or whatever it might be, you know, with other projects I do with other people. And, you know, like sometimes, you know, it's important to put your point across, and they might have their point and you listen to their point and they listen to your point as well. You know, after a couple days, the dust settles a bit, and then people are more open then to, you know, they've had time to think about it, they've had time to whatever and that kind of thing. So that's usually how that works, I find. And it can be painful. So, well, but I think it's good not to give up. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, let me ask you, as a person that studied the Meyer material a lot, I would guess you would probably agree, maybe you don't, that a disclosure from the government, I mean, I wouldn't imagine that you would be needing much of a disclosure from the government on this topic, would you?
No. In fact, they were quite helpful when they tried to sweep it all under the rug. So that's how I made my calculations to find the case in the first place. So no, you don't need the government to do anything for you. I think that would just kind of, given how much religion and so on is already influencing the government, there's, first of all, very, very little likelihood that that's going to happen anyways. And I don't think it would be very well received in the first place by a lot of people. And so it's something that people have to come to on their own.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm just really glad to hear you say that.
It's not easy to understand for people. And I've had this conversation with other people, too, before.
Oh,
oh yeah, for sure. And, you know, they don't see it that way. You know, they might already be non-religious in their own minds and all that stuff, but they don't realize that there is a large percentage of the world out there that is still very stuck on, you know, old ideas, Bronze Age mythology, whatever it might be. And, you know, it's easy for them to say, well, yeah, I would be fine, you know, if they just open contact, but a lot of people wouldn't be, and that would certainly not be very beneficial for the Pleiaren, for us, for anybody, because, you know, then the Pleiaren would you know, we, the first thing we would want to do, our governments would want to do, is ask them for their technology, right?
Yeah,
that's always the first thing. And then the next thing, we turn it into a military thing, and then we'd become a threat to them. Well, that's jolly great. I mean, what the hell does that accomplish? Absolutely nothing. We see what we do with the technology we have today. You know, we bomb each other, we kill each other, and we develop new technologies to go and kill each other more efficiently. I mean, hello. You know, they're developing all these robots today and all these things now that, oh yeah, you know, some scientists, you know, some la-di-da idiot scientist is just saying, sitting there, you know, designing all this stuff. And, well, yeah, I'm sorry, it's not like it's going to be pushing trolley carts for old ladies, you know, in the supermarket. I mean, they're going to be using those for war. I mean, there's no question. So, I mean, most of the U.S. funding, government funding, goes to war. So it's like $600 or $700 billion a year now, or some crazy thing.
Who knows? So, who knows, man? It's a lot. It's a lot.
It's more than like the next 12 countries combined. So it's ridiculous. So I don't.
I wanted to do the show today on human origins, meaning the origins of Earth humans.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that's also very different from the UFO community. They like to use the word aliens a lot. Mm-hmm. And when they use the word human, they mean it only for us here on the Earth. And they have no idea that there are humans all over the place.
Right.
And that humans are the norm in terms of intelligent life, rather than not the norm. So we have a lot of different. So I wanted to start out just talking in general terms about Billy again. He, when he was growing up in northern Switzerland, in Bulak, Switzerland, right after World War II, he, first of all, he had his own epiphany when he was a small boy, maybe 4 years old. About 3 a.m. one morning, he crawled out a lower window of his bedroom, and it was a warm May evening, and he sat down on the bench and he looked up at a beautiful starry sky, and he said, "My life is made out of the love of creation." And it's worded this way. It says he heard his own voice say, which I find very interesting. He heard his own voice say, "Since ancient times, I've lived among the stars." And he said he knew at that point what his purpose in life was and what space and time mean in terms of the life of mankind. He also talked about the light of the stars and that they emitted an invisible light, which he called the love of creation. So what I'm recalling right now is an article that he wrote called How It All Began. Have you ever had a chance to read that, Daniel?
I'm not sure. I'm.
You got to read that.
I've read you know, certain things on certain articles that have been translated, of course, and I'm not sure how extensive that is, but you know, certainly I have the timeline open right now too on the Future of Mankind website and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's good. I'll have to send you that link. How It All Began is one of the most fantastic things he's ever written, I think. One of my favorites. It's because I don't know, there's something about him as a young boy that has really captured my imagination. And I still think in many ways, even at my age now, I relate very much to how he felt as a young boy.
Right.
You know,
yeah, it was just as you were describing it, I'm like, yeah, that's how I felt too.
Later in life, he started to have these telepathic messages from this man named Svoth, and he started to get metal images, and he was told to go out to the forest near his home in Bulak and wait, and then out of the sky came this silvery pear-shaped craft, which would land nearby the ship. The door would open on the ship, Svoth would step out. And here's a man with white hair and a white beard he's nearly 900 years old, and through some kind of technology, he would bring young Billy up into the ship, and they would take off, and they would go up into Earth orbit. And I've always found it interesting that one of the things that Sfoth talked to Billy about is his previous lives. And he told him that he had been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And that in each one of these lives, he taught this ancient universal teaching called the Teaching of the Spirit, which deals with the universal consciousness, which is also called the creation, the human spirit, things like learning to control our thinking, learning to take responsibility. So I always found that so interesting, is that one of the first things that Sfoth told him is who he was in his previous lives. Do you remember reading that from...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's something that hasn't happened in my life. So.
No one's told you.
No. So that's where we diverge, I guess. But yeah. Yeah, no, it is interesting. And I guess when he was a young boy, I guess he started taking him to different places to look around and witnessing the Second World War and stuff like that too, eh? So
he told him about that the United States would drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right.
Told him that people would try to kill him when he got older.
Yeah.
Told him that even the people in his organization, some of them would turn against him, that his wife would turn against him.
Yeah.
That he would have a life filled with a lot of suffering.
Right.
That he would lose his left arm in a bus accident, and that there was nothing that he could do to avoid that, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
You'd think you could figure out one way to avoid it, but maybe not.
Yeah, I hadn't thought that through much, but I guess they did mention that it would be useful for his conscious development and so on in terms of self-control and all that kind of thing. And I guess over the months and so forth that followed, I guess that's basically what occurred, yeah.
You know, what's interesting, too, is I remember them saying that him getting married would also help the mission, even though there was a lot of problems with his marriage.
Well, for sure, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's not something I would envy, that's for sure.
No. Yeah. So anyway, this is just a short, brief overview, and I'm tempted to go into the story with Asket and their first meeting. But I don't know if I should. I talk about that a lot. And I want to move on maybe to some material that people are a little less familiar with. And let me step forward to, for whatever reason, the Talmud of Emmanuel. This is a very interesting thing because this is something I was aware of. Of course, I'm aware of the Talmud of Emmanuel. Let me just throw this out and then you can comment too, Daniel.
Sure.
The Talmud of Emmanuel, we had the first release of it, which I'll get into in a minute. The Talmud of Emmanuel came allegedly, I'll say allegedly because I can't prove any of this, from an ancient scroll that was discovered by a Greek Orthodox priest named Issa Rashid and Billy Meyer, and allegedly discovered this, and correct me if I get any of these details wrong, in Jerusalem, I think right around the middle 1950s or so. Issa Rashid did the translation. I believe the scroll was originally written in Aramaic, and
yes,
it got partially done before Issa Rashid was machine gunned by the Mossad, the secret service of the Israelis. I guess one of the groups that wanted to suppress this material were the Zionists, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But they burned the scroll because they burned down the house where it was in. and they killed Issa Rashid and his family. They machine gunned him to death. But Billy had gotten a pretty good chunk of the translation to Switzerland. Now,
so it was a third, yeah.
Go ahead.
It was about a third of it, I think, yeah.
Okay, about a third. That's a good point. The this is where things get extremely controversial, and I always have to take a neutral stance on this, because when it comes to the Talmud of Emmanuel information, this is the part of the Meyer material that I kind of would steer away from, mm-hmm. because, and I've talked about this many times on the show, that for me, it just seemed very unlikely that we would have, boy, and was I ever wrong? Let me say this. It's one of them times when you have to, you know, confess, boy, I was really wrong about this.
Yeah.
I figured that there's no way that we could have gotten the name wrong of the central figure of Western society, Jesus Christ. I figured, you know, I don't know what the whole Meyer material is doing here, but I'm not going to be anti this information. But I'm just going to kind of still steer clear of it for a while. And I decided to do some research on my own. And lo and behold, I stumbled across the fact that the letter J really didn't exist in any languages on Earth, any of the Earth-originating languages. The Lyrian had the letter J, but none of the Earth languages did until, some scholars will argue, right around 1550. So whatever this man's name was, you know, the Meyer material says his name was Emmanuel. The 1611 version of the King James Bible, the very first one, would identify him as IESVS, which is kind of a close, you know, an attempt at a transliteration. There was no letter J in the original Bibles that were translated into English, because there was no J in the English language at that time. Right. There was no J in the Hebrew. There was no J in the Aramaic. There was no J in the Greek. So they went back and changed these names. For example, the original name of the book of Job was the book of Iob. And James and John had completely different names that began with a Y that are very, very difficult for us English-speaking people to pronounce. I don't have the particular notes in front of me. Julius Caesar had a different name that didn't begin with a J. So what they did,
right.
Like people like, the guy that quote-unquote invented the letter J, and this is a little bit controversial too, about exactly when it was invented, but Giorgio Torricino, he was an Italian scholar and a playwright, is said to have invented the letter J right around 1550 as a substitution for I and Y under certain conditions. So, you know, the Bible was considered the word of God among religious circles, but they didn't have any hesitation in going in and changing all of the peoples whose name began with a Y or an I to the letter J. So Yaakov, or whatever the name of James and John was, became James and John. Iob, the book of Iob, became the book of Job. The person that was called by, for example, the Latin translators as Jesus or Iesus, they started calling him Jesus for whatever reason. So there's been a lot of strange things that have happened in our history. So that was huge for me.
Yeah.
Because I came from a religious background. I used to teach Bible studies the whole nine yards.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I was into it, man. And I still have a great respect for the books, both the Old and the New Testament. But when I learned this, because this is pure logic. You cannot argue with logic and facts. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no letter J in the ancient languages. He could not have been called Jesus.
Right.
They started calling him Jesus later. You can argue that his name was Yeshua, or Jesus or Jesus or Emmanuel, but you can't even make a logical argument that his name was Jesus, and the whole religious world calls him Jesus.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Have you read James Dierdorf's book?
I have read his website. I've studied his website, but I don't think I've bought his book. I had him on the show a couple of times.
Oh, cool.
And he was still around.
Right. Yeah, I got his book a few years ago. I found it secondhand and went through it. And he went through it line for line between the Bibles, the different versions of the Bible, and Mark and Matthew, I guess it was. And then he went to look at different Christian scholars and not, that kind of thing, and their interpretations of each line, comparing it with the Talmud and looking at historical points when certain things were happening, such as, for example, when Emmanuel would have been born. You know, was it around the time when I think it had something to do with Herod, and mm-hmm. there was another King Herod, and then there was like these two different characters, and it was kind of confusing, so it's very, very interesting. That was actually, to me, a much more interesting read than the actual Talmud, because, you know, there's all these comparisons that you can look at while you're reading it line for line, and I found that particularly interesting, actually, because, you know, I also grew up in, you know, a Christian environment. I was never really into it, but, you know, I certainly had it around me lots, and family and friends, and my family would certainly seek out other people that were Christians and stuff. And so I was always hanging out with, you know, families, kids and so on that went to Bible schools and stuff. And I would go to their youth groups just to play the games, you know, and stuff like that, not for the Christianity stuff. But then they would do the Bible studies, and I would just be sitting there making jokes the whole time. So it wasn't really, you know, I don't think I was really welcome in that, community, but I certainly had to go to church every Sunday and all that stuff too. But I found his book particularly interesting. And I think actually there was some mention of the letter J being used in terms of the letter I that we use today, like in mm-hmm. terms of pronouncing E. So like mm-hmm. Emmanuel. So it was, I think it was a J, but it wasn't J. It wasn't that J sound. It was an E sound. It was to pronounce the I, the letter I. Mm. So Emmanuel. But I don't know how that ties in with what you're talking about. It's not something I've actually looked into. So, but it would be interesting to see his notes and comparing with what you're mentioning here with the letter J. And
well, yeah, maybe that's something you can do someday if you have some time, and you could.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, the other thing, and this is extremely controversial, and maybe I'll jump into this now. Now, let me read this. This is from Contact Report 238, because one of the things that people have done is they've really studied that first version of the Talmud very closely. But there were huge problems with it, and I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so let me continue here. And this is Contact Report 238, starting at line 7. It says, actually, I was just about to call you when I saw the book Leaves of the Talmud and the manual on your desk, and I was astonished to find out that you had corrected the entire script. And this compelled me to investigate the matter more closely. A not mild shock seized me when I looked through the printed copy that's been in circulation for many years, which we don't have in our possession for reasons that are well known to you, for it isn't decisive for us in reference to the teaching. But still we are aware of the exact contents, and these were not identical to my browsing of the script. So I quickly went back into my aircraft and ordered the control element of the control disk to turn on, which I then promptly examined, and I noticed that at the time in the 70s, you coded everything correctly in accordance with the translations of Isa Rashid, but then due to lack of time, you sent the pure copy of the manuscript to a female person by the name of Crower, K-R-A-U-E-R, and then paid 1,460 francs for it. But then this person mutilated and falsified the Talmud of Emmanuel, and your code, and Billy, and you can comment on this, Daniel, Billy has a code that he writes in the German that it has to do with the arrangement of the words and everything, and it somehow speaks to our subconscious, right?
Right, yeah. I guess it doesn't translate into English, but that's...
Right.
Right.
And your code to such an extent that the Talmud became as good as worthless for the mission. So that's them saying the first version of the Talmud. And I think I have the first version somewhere up there as well.
Wasn't there a mention of her actually being her previous life or something? She had
been part of
something similar to this?
I'll get to that. It's really interesting. Okay. The Talmud became as worthless for the mission and for the determinations and for the code-affected persons. And since you couldn't spare any more time at the time in order to look through and correct the copy, the falsified Talmud of Emmanuel was then printed with all the changes, omissions, and falsifications without you knowing anything about the destruction of the code and the contents of the writing. Only through the fact that the Talmud was sent to you by an American publishing company for inspection and correction because it wanted to publish the work, did you then discover the evil machinations of the copyist? I, however, was interested in the reason behind this act, so I endeavored to get an exact clarification, whereby I came across things and connections that have surprised me, just as they will surely also do with you. Until yesterday, I strove for a clarification of the things surrounding the falsification of the Talmud of Emmanuel and surrounding the destruction of your code. And what resulted was really astonishing. This person, Crower, is not just an uncommon Israel-related sympathizer, but also a follower of Zionism, for whom every means it is right which contributes to the achieving of world domination by the Zionists. However, the whole situation with her didn't just happen out of nowhere, because it is based on a very specific background, which surprised me greatly. My remaining investigations revealed that the person Crier also lived during Emmanuel's lifetime and came into direct contact with Emmanuel. But at that time, her gender wasn't female, as it is now, but rather male. And at that time, her current spirit form animated the Pharisee Simon, or Simeon, S-I-M-E-O-N, who was the father of the traitor, and they call the traitor Judas Iscariot, rather than Iscariot. I guess there were two, right?
Right.
Two Judases. One was actually a very loyal follower, Judas Iscariot, of Emmanuel. Anyway.
And the other one was the son of a lawyer or something, wasn't he?
The other one was the son of Pharisee Simeon, who was this female that we were just talking about in later life that screwed up the original Talmud.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's amazing.
It is, yeah. Well, there seems to be... It certainly mentions, it talks about, or at least it outlines, I mean, sort of what happens in the reincarnation cycles too, in terms of our frequency or vibration or whatever we are, where we are at in our thinking, maybe, to some extent, at least our wisdom. That's very interesting.
So you're saying that our thinking, our vibration re-manifests in later lives in sometimes similar ways.
It seems to be that our wisdom, our currently attained wisdom, it doesn't change as much over a period of a lifetime, especially if somebody doesn't work on it that much.
Oh, wow.
So that's I guess even if somebody does work on it lots, it's still a fairly slow process.
And we have similar behaviors many times, like in the case of this Simeon, who was a Pharisee, and this woman who trashed the original version of the Talmud. It's, I mean, because this Pharisee, Simeon, Simeon was the father of Judah Iheriot. So
yeah, and he was embarrassed. He was embarrassed, I guess, when his son killed himself or whatever, and Judas Iscariot had fled with Emmanuel to India at that point after he'd been crucified and survived and was brought back to health, and they fled to India. And so Judas Iscariot was not there to defend himself when his name was dragged through the mud in this way. So they just basically said it was him that was the traitor, and this guy was just embarrassed that it was his own son, but or something like that. So, yeah.
That's fascinating. That's very fascinating. Yeah. Another thing that's fascinating in the Emmanuel teaching, I think, and it's in my notes in these piles, in these books. I have to go searching through it. Emmanuel said, the body comes from the spirit, and that the body and the spirit are one. They are not separate. You know, we don't have a trinity, and really the body and the spirit, you know, the body comes from the spirit. It's just a different form of matter, which I always thought was just so profound. You know, we are an extension of that tiny fragment of the universal consciousness. Everything, you know, even our physical body.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to think about, isn't it? And when you're out in nature alone and you kind of see all of the things living around you and the grass and the trees and the flowers and the whatever animals and things about, you know, you kind of start thinking about these kinds of things too. It's pretty interesting, you know, what comes up.
I often, when I think about the spirit form, think of my cats, because four of the cats were born in my boat in the garage about 2 years ago.
Okay.
So I saw them from when they first came out of their mother. And so I've seen these personalities, you know,
right,
appear out of these little creatures. So I always think about their spirit forms coming out of the spirit realm into my garage.
Right.
Manifesting in these cats, you know, and they all have the most interesting different personalities. Yeah. The other thing I think of in relation to the spirit form is we have... in the woods here, for whatever reason, we probably have very fertile ground because we have gigantic plants that will grow. And they're just some variation on weeds, I guess. But they can be 6 and 7 feet tall by the middle of June.
Wow.
So, and I think of this spirit form coming out of the spirit realm. And then I assume these plants grow from some kind of seed. And then this thing just growing this incredible weight. I mean, yeah, they're taller than me, and they've only been in the material world a month or two.
Right.
That's a phenomenal thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was interesting. I was reading a book years and years, years before I got into the Meyer stuff, and they were just talking about, you know, when you look at a giant redwood tree or... you know, something, a big, big tree like that, you know, and you're trying to find out where did it come from? Where did that idea manifest? And then you go and look in the seed of the tree and you open up the seed, you know, you got an acorn or whatever it is. And, you know, how did it create that? And I guess it's, you know, it's an idea, it's potential of a tree, but how did it attract just the right nutrients and just the right, you know, ways and so on for it to grow this magnificent, massive, huge tree, just this tiny little, you know, seed. And it's just amazing to think about. I guess I thought about it at the time in terms of sort of like vibration, you know, it's got a certain frequency and it attracts things that are in the frequency that it needs to grow and to attract the nutrients that it needs in order to grow. And so I always found that very, 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 very interesting because, you know, what is a thought? Where does an idea come from? How does it develop? How does it grow into something real that really manifests into reality, into real life, and so on? And that I just find is such an important part of our study as human beings. And, you know, it gives us insight in terms of really taking control of our own thoughts and not just being vegetables, you know, not just letting life happen to you, but to actually be there consciously creating an outcome that is, you know, positive. And I think, yeah, it's just, if we don't study that, then everything else we do, you know, it's going to be halfway, you know, it's going to be partial results with not really good results, you know, all the time. And it's just not very focused, you know. And but when you learn about the manifestation of thoughts and how it manifests into reality and so on, into the physical reality and the physical world, you know, you can certainly see our world today as a manifestation. All the problems and things are a manifestation of the contradictions that people hold in their own minds today about how the universe operates. And they're not operating with software, so to speak, in their minds that is going to make that tree grow, you know, in a sense. It's not going to, the ideas that are being grown right now, you know, like people have an idea that they want to do, and then you know, there's certain realities that they're ignoring, and then those realities will encroach and destroy it. So you really have to learn the laws of cause and effect at the same time, and if it's not logical, then it'll fall apart.
I think now that I'm listening to you talk and I've seen the direction the conversation's going, I think we've really bitten off something huge here. And I think it will take probably at least a series of programs probably to do it justice.
Yeah, well, you know, I spent a long time just thinking about that one thought, that one idea. How does an idea manifest? And that, I think, is very important if you have goals, if you want to do anything good in this world, and you want it to last for a long time, in a way that doesn't collapse and die in on itself like all of the contradictions that we're seeing today are doing.
Well, let me quickly repeat the basics of reincarnation. That seems to be part of my role in life. Some people that later listen to this archive that may not have ever heard the law of reincarnation. It's the law of nature. In terms of a human being, 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg, something called the spirit form comes in to the child out of the spirit realm. The spirit realm, I've heard described as an energy band around our planet. It's in a different dimension, and we could probably do a whole show on what another dimension really means. It's a term I don't like. But the spirit form comes out of the spirit realm, and it brings with it a new personality. It brings with it a new consciousness. Now, we have, in many ways, three consciousnesses, you could say: a conscious mind, a subconscious mind, and an unconscious mind. Our subconscious mind plays a really important role because it, in part, contains an essence of our past life memories. The past life memories are also stored in something called the storage banks. Now, there's a storage bank associated with the planet, with the solar system that you live in, with the galaxy. Every galaxy in our universe has a storage bank. Every solar system has a storage bank. Every planet has a storage bank. And your life from your previous life information is also stored in these storage banks. As Daniel said, there's something to do with frequency here, because you can, if only subconsciously, can access the information that's in the storage bank from your previous life. Now, I was talking earlier about how it all began, that article Billy wrote where he was inadvertently accessing the information from the storage banks about his previous lives. And he started saying things, you know, like, in ancient times I lived among the stars. So he was getting overwhelmed with all this information, because signals come out of these storage banks, and all we have to do is be sensitive to them. So as you're growing up again, and you've done it before, as you're growing up again, you're getting impulses from these storage banks, and part of the impulses that you're getting could be from your previous lives. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very important what you think at the moment of death. This is something that I've been reading in the book called The Way to Live. Because when you become close to the time of dying, your attitude about dying will go into the storage banks. And during your next life, particularly at the very young age, you will access that information, if only subconsciously or unconsciously. And it will affect your whole next lifetime. So we really have to, A, be prepared for death, and B, learn to control our thoughts. Through one example of learning to control your thoughts is through meditation. And Billy says something really profound in the book, and The Way to Live. He said, meditation is evolution. Whoa, that's pretty important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these signals from your previous life at your moment of dying will profoundly affect you at an early age, and they will affect your whole life. So it's very important to get a handle on controlling your thoughts and meditation and preparation for death. Anyway,
you know how it's interesting. I just want to let you get back to your thought here in a minute. You know, with the whole idea of the storage banks and all this stuff, I noticed it in music, because even from a very, very young age, I was very advanced, I guess, naturally advanced in the sense that I could pick up on styles, music styles, mm-hmm. without any effort whatsoever, and no other musicians around me were like that. And I couldn't explain it. I didn't practice more than them, but it just came out. And even before a concert sometimes, or before a show, or before anything, I will think to myself, God, I suck. I don't have anything in my brain. I don't know what I'm going to do. There's no, you know, like, I don't see myself as a musician. But when I start playing, all the stuff starts coming out. It just comes out. It's just there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's the weirdest thing. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to explain it. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the subconscious versus the conscious in that sense. Because, you know, the storage banks are in your subconscious. I know Billy talks about music being actually a very, 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 very useful way to meditate and to develop your understanding of the consciousness. I can attest to that on my own experience. I didn't need Billy to ever tell me that. It's so true, because you discover things about yourself that you had no idea existed. Hmm. It just comes out. It's a subconscious thing. It's like, if you let yourself explore it, if you don't mind looking stupid for a while, whatever, just step out. Take the jump, take the leap, You know, that's what playing music is like. It's not like just pressing play on a stereo and just, you know, passively listening. It's you're actually involved. You're actually there in the moment, and you're always present and so on. It is a meditation. And you are discovering different facets of your mind in terms of thinking and present, because you're always having to be present in music. You can't just, like I say, you can't just press play and it happens for you. But, you know, it's... In some ways, it does just happen, but you have to be active in the process at the same time. And the things you find, the things you discover that come out, it's amazing. It's really fun. Really, really a wonderful experience. And I encourage anybody here listening to take up an instrument. You know, don't worry about sounding stupid. Don't worry if you think you have no talent or whatever it is. You know, I started just learning really, really basics, and that's how we all learned a language, you know, when we were little kids. We all started with the basics, mama, dada, you know, whatever, goo goo gaga, whatever. And if you're not afraid to go through that process and to look like an idiot, I think you'll have a lot more room to grow in your life. I think, you know, like I'm learning German now. And it's the same process that I went through when I was learning music. And of course, I'm not as talented as I was with music in German, but that's another story for another time. But, you know, just music is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful way to explore your consciousness, because it's so different from any other art form, because you really are forced to be present. It's not like just painting a painting. Like, of course, you have to be present to paint a painting too, but once it's done, it's done. You know, whereas music, you come back to it the next day and maybe there's something you need to work on that you were doing better the previous day. You know, it's a very, very wonderful thing that keeps you in the present, because I paint as well. And it's very easy to say, oh, I'm a great painter. Look, I did this painting. And then, you know, a couple of years later, you start painting again, and you realize how much you suck all of a sudden, because you haven't practiced, you know. So whereas being a musician, you're constantly being forced to be in the present and to constantly explore that. And Billy really talks about music being a wonderful way to explore the consciousness. I can only recommend it. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's very good. Very good points. Very, very true information. You know, I originally wanted to start out talking about human origins, like Earth human origins, but I think you really this is really good that we've started with the spirit form and with reincarnation first.
Yeah,
because that's really the basis for all of it. The Meyer information explains and. That humans on Earth, there is really a thing called an Earth human. And we started on this planet, I believe, 9 to 12 million years ago. Started to evolve naturally. The first mammal on Earth, I've heard called Adelobasialis cromptoni, which is something like what you might call a shrew, which evolved came into being about 225 million years ago, and then slowly became a primate. Now, the primates split off into two directions. Some became humans, and others became apes. The humans began to develop a consciousness. A different kind of intelligence than just an animal. The animals do have intelligence, but we humans are different in that we have something called the consciousness. So we have a higher awareness, and that comes from the kind of spirit form that we have. Our spirit form is often called a tiny fragment of the universal consciousness, and I think of it as like a hologram. It's Semyase, one of Billy's contacts, called it the wonder of all wonders. And she said that every person has a spirit that never sleeps, that records all of your thoughts and impulsations, and it's called the Bearer of the Creative Realm. And I think that's what Daniel was talking about there, is the spirit form is really, when you really play good music, you're getting influence from the spirit form.
Absolutely.
And it's this neutral, positive energy, which just bathes your whole self.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a knowing, which is really difficult to put into conscious words. If you
other people might also have that in other areas of life, not just music too, right? So there are people who are born with, you know, talents in mathematics or talents in science or talents towards, you know, other forms of art or maybe dancing or, you know, all those other things too. So there's certainly something to be said for that as well.
So 9 to 12 million years ago, humans started to evolve on the Earth. They started to develop normally. Now, life on Earth is not normal. Let me say that, because there were a lot of visitors here. And there were other planets in our solar system that had life in the ancient, ancient past, which is really a special. We have a very special solar system. Currently on Earth, we have five different kinds of human beings who are of extraterrestrial origins. These human beings came from different places. They came from Mars. They came from Melona, which was another planet in our solar system, which was destroyed. They came from the constellation of Lyra/Vega and from the Sirius region, in a different space-time configuration. We could spend a whole show on that. And there are Chinese and Japanese races who came here from a planet called Kudra. And this is a very, very long, big topic that I guess we're just going to introduce this evening. Let me start out talking about Mars. Because some of us came from Mars. In Contact Report 210, Ptah, one of Billy's contacts, explains that Mars had large amounts of water on it in the ancient past. He said that he talked about 1,000-fold more water than found in the largest rivers of Earth. Now, this is astonishing because we think of Mars today as a planet covered with sand and dust. Earth has rivers, but what was on Mars was truly enormous rivers that were dozens and even almost hundreds of kilometers in diameter and thousands of kilometers in length. Now, an interesting thing that's talked about too. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's amazing. Go ahead. Yeah. I'm just listening.
In our future, we've looked way in the past to Mars. Let's look to the future now, which this comes from Contact Report 251. We'll talk about Mars in the future. Well, aggression with Martian inhabitants will begin again, it says in the Meyer Contact Report 251. So eventually we'll go to Mars again. I assume it will be the people on Earth going to Mars again and starting life. And there'll be wars between, of course, this is, I don't know if the Meyer people stay, this is still our potential future or not. But they talked about, let me read it here. It says, aggressions with Martian inhabitants will begin again and result in actual launching of attacks on the colonies of Mars, the 13 colonies of Mars. Very interesting.
These are our own colonies that we're going to be building ourselves, I assume.
I assume that.
Yeah.
The events will be followed by 15 years of relative calm, finally bringing good fortune to the Earth human inhabitants in their quest to find their actual origins, which is really fascinating. A very vicious and aggressive act takes place on the man's neighbor planet, Mars, when numerous spaceships will attack and completely annihilate the planet until even its substance is eliminated. What that exactly means is really scary. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So in the future, there will be this horrific war. At least, I know that some of the predictions, well, I should say prophecies from Contact Report 251 are no longer valid. I'm hoping that's the case with that one as well, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's hard to say, I guess, because we're nowhere near that stage yet. I mean, we are in cosmic terms, but certainly not in in the near future. I mean, if America goes belly up the way it's going, and other countries are going belly up the way they're going, then I don't know how many resources we're going to be able to put towards putting people on Mars anytime soon. But let's hope we can.
Let's hope. Yeah, definitely. Let's hope. You know, I this topic is so huge. And we've had such a good introduction, and it's only been an hour. Maybe we should keep it at an hour and
sure,
and leave the rest for another day.
Sounds good to me.
I have nothing planned as far as other guests, so it's good to come back home to the Meyer material. Hopefully, someone listening that's never heard the Meyer material before is going to say, "No wonder these guys study this stuff."
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about it when you were talking in the first part of the interview, when you were mentioning your other guests and stuff. And I find a lot of these people are talking about the cover-ups and things about this, about Fukushima, about UFOs, about this and that and so on. And whereas Meyer just goes right into the material, and there's no aspect of you don't have to really talk about the cover-ups because the material is just so extensive.
Yeah. Everything more than you could possibly process in your whole life has been opened up to us and disclosed.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a disclosure, I think, right here, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's up to people to find it for themselves, and that would be true even if the governments did disclose it. So it's still up to people, individuals, to come to terms with all this stuff on their own, regardless of what happens. So
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah,
Daniel, thanks for joining me this evening.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I always really enjoy our chats, and I hope other people get something out of it as well. So it's always a pleasure.
All righty. We'll talk to you hopefully real soon. Have a good evening.
Sounds good. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.